The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm a producer and editor here in the Author Events office, and it's my honor to introduce tonight's author. Isaac J. Bailey is the author of the memoir, My Brother Moochie, a raw, firsthand account of the author's older brother's longtime incarceration for a murder that The Guardian called a painful indictment of American inhumanity woven with threads of grace and love. The James K. Batten Professor of Public Policy at Davidson College, Bailey was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University and taught journalism at Coastal Carolina University. His award-winning work has been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Time, amongst many other periodicals, and he has appeared on many networks, including NPR, CNN, and MSNBC. Tonight, he is here with his new book, Why Didn't We Riot? A Black Man in Trump Land. Addressing such topics as Confederate iconography, police brutality, and white discomfort, this essay collection explores what it means to be Black in Trump's America. Kirkus Reviews calls it a, quote, powerful lesson in history and truth that is brilliant, searing, and surprisingly vulnerable. Tonight, Mr. Bailey will be in conversation with Philadelphia's own Tracy Matisak, an award-winning broadcaster, journalist, and great friend of the Free Library and the Free Library Author Events Office. Isaac and Tracy, the screen is all yours.
All right. Well, thank you so much and welcome, everyone. So glad that you could be with us on a rather rainy evening here in the Philadelphia area, but I am absolutely delighted to be here with Isaac Bailey. And I just want to underscore what Jason said about the Q&A, that we've budgeted some time toward the end of our conversation for your questions. So you can just click on that Q&A icon at the bottom of your screen and type your question in there, and we will get to as many of them as we can. But that said, Isaac Bailey, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It's like, thank you very much for having me. Yeah.
So you start off the book, before we kind of do a deep dive on the book, early on, you make a prediction about the presidential election. And your prediction was that Donald Trump would receive 60% of the white vote, or that at least he would receive even more than he received the last time. And if the exit polls are correct, it sounds like you were pretty spot on. It's looking like about 57% or so. So let me just ask you, first of all, your reaction to the results of the election.
Yes, I'm so glad that Trump is on his way out. Yes, I think that there is this sort of cloud that is kind of lifting. Yes, and also though that actually does not mean that I actually want things to go back to normal. Yes, in term, let me ask me, but like I, yes, like I sort of actually just want things to get better. And I think that this is the first step towards that. Mm-hmm. I am still sort of torn though, at least like actually when it comes to the white vote, simply because it is still hard to swallow how any kind of racial group could have actually looked at the past 4 years and like actually said, give me more. And yet that that is what we have actually with the white vote. So like that part of it is something to think about still.
Well, and interestingly, Isaac, I'm wondering how you account for the increase in minority votes for Trump this time as well. The New York Times says that 8% of Black women voted for him, which is double the amount of last time. 18% of Black men voted for Trump. And I think it was something like 13% the last time. So what do you make of that, that he, and certainly the Latino vote as well, but I'm thinking of Black voters in particular. What do you make of that?
Yeah. I mean, like, well, and like one is that, especially with like this early sort of like data point, especially sort of actually with like the exit polls, that we actually need to be like very careful with them, simply because like they are not exact. And also sort of, especially this year, like of course, like it actually was like much harder, like in order to like actually really get that right, simply because like of the pandemic and also like the sort of like massive, like mail-in vote, et cetera, like all those sort of things. And yet though that, even if those numbers were accurate, for instance, well, yes, and then that, like all that, like actually shows, like is that, like they sort of like actually have actually gone back the sort of like George W. Bush era numbers. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and I believe in sort of like 1 year, he actually got like either between like 11 or sort of like 13% like of the Black vote, like and also sort of like 40%. Like of the Hispanic vote. I mean, yes, so like essentially like what happened kind of like in between that time, of course, I'm sort of like actually like was the sort of my nation's my first Black president, which sort of like actually changed everything, which means that like if you actually take out his numbers, this sort of like is the sort of this is sort of the kind of like norm, at least like actually for the Black vote, like and like the GOP.
So those numbers, I guess, in that respect may not be so surprising, because that's what you might normally see. Is that what you're saying? What do you think about President Trump's refusal to acknowledge the results of the election?
As a journalist, it has been a struggle, at least to like actually try to find the sort of like right way to balance this out, and because one like is that he actually will be gone on January 20th. I don't have any doubts about that. And yet though, like he can like actually cause a he can still like actually cause damage, like actually right now, and also. Which is like the thing that really, really concerns me most. Yes, like, and because especially in sort of like states like mine, for instance, there are a lot of Trump fans who are sort of who actually believe in a lot of conspiracy theories.
Right.
And so like for me, like, I don't want this to go on so long that like it is actually going to like sort of actually deepen that. And then like, and also to like actually possibly sort of like actually call somebody to act. Yes, like, and also so like lastly, of course, that this is who this man is. I mean, that's just the bottom line. Yes, and then so that, this is not a surprise, unfortunately.
So before we do a deep dive into the book, I have one other question regarding the election for you, Isaac. And that is that, you know, the conventional wisdom has been that so many white Americans voted for Donald Trump in 2016 because of economic angst, because they felt like they were not being heard. And in the book, you kind of deconstruct that and you dismantle that theory. Why do you think that's not the case?
Yes. I mean, it's like one is is the fact that like it sort of like actually was like actually built on this like falsehood. Especially with the fact that our economy at the time like was actually growing. Yes, like, and also the fact that we sort of actually like were on the sort of longest streak of sort of job creation kind of lead in our history. In sort of like 2015, for instance, we actually had the sort of my highest sort of my highest increase, like in sort of that income, like actually like four people, and also they sort of like middle class. And yet, at least like actually during that period, yes, and then that you actually had Trump, who was like actually calling all of that fake news, you know, cookbooks, et cetera, like all of that stuff. And yet, as soon as he actually got elected, yes, and then that suddenly he and his supporters were bragging about those numbers and like actually saying that it actually was because of Trump, which wasn't accurate. Yes, like, and also sort of my sort of main point on that, like, is the fact that especially for black and brown people, for instance, were actually hurting more than white people. Mm. At least like, actually when it came to the economy. And yet
they did not vote for Donald Trump.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Isaac, I want to ask you about the title of your book, which is Why Didn't We Riot? The subtitle is A Black Man in Trump Land. What's the significance of that title? And tell us how you would describe Trump Land.
Yeah. I mean, I was trying to use the image like of a riot just to express my anger and frustration. Yes, like, and also sort of, especially because, like, over, like, the past 4 years, like, I saw media, sort of, journalists, actually focused on Trump supporters so much that, they essentially ignored all of the, all of the folks, like, who actually looked like me, in places like this. Mm. And then so like for me, especially when it comes to that so-called Trump land, like I actually see that like as this area where there are a lot of Trump supporters which we have to deal with like everywhere, like at school, like at church, at the baseball game, et cetera, like that, just like, and also that, actually have to deal with like other folks, like who are actually constantly telling us, not deal with the racism, simply because like it actually might hurt their feelings. Mm.
So in that respect, Trump land can be really anywhere in the USA. It's certainly not right. Confined to the South where you live.
Correct, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was interested, Isaac, to read about your struggles as a journalist, and especially when you were working in print, in writing, not only writing about race, but even talking with your colleagues in the newsroom about race. And you write about the challenge of trying to write honestly about race and then sort of managing the risk, right, between being honest and protecting the feelings of your white readers and your colleagues, and maybe even risking losing your job. Can you talk a little bit about your experience and sort of how you navigated that tightrope?
Yes. That was exhausting. Yes, because one of the things about this, like, is that like it actually wasn't about, you know, racism per se, like in terms of sort of like, yes, in terms of like somebody like actually like purposely, at least like actually trying to be racist towards, no, not that. I mean, yes, but that like it actually was more difficult, simply because like it actually was, like it was actually coming from white colleagues, and sort of who actually thought that they were doing me a favor, like actually by the actually trying to guide me through, you know, race and racism, et cetera. And then that, I'm a yes, and then that, what was really frustrating about that, was the fact that I sort of actually had done I mean, like all of the work on these issues. Like I sort of actually had actually done like all of the research and the critical thinking, et cetera. And yet that they were like actually still actually trying to guide me on something that had not really fully explored.
You had done all the homework.
Yes. Yes. Yes, like, and also that even as I was telling them that there is actually going to be a certain portion like of our audience, who would always see me as the Black dude, actually judge me no matter what. And yet though that they actually could not hear me say that. And also sort of like pressure me like in order to like actually try to get through to those readers anyway. And so like that actually was exhausting, you know, like yeah. As I said earlier.
Isaac, I want to take a moment because I'd love to share with our audience just a little passage from your book to give people kind of a flavor of your writing and just a little sampling for those who have not yet read the book. It says, "It's not happenstance that there has never been racial equality in America, a country which coupled race-based chattel slavery with its demand for liberty and justice. That makes the Black story unique in ways I wish it wasn't. We don't know what it feels like to just be American in a country that from the beginning hated and despised us for being Black and now hates and despises us for refusing to relinquish that Blackness. And yet here we are, still rising. Though they enslaved us, we didn't give up. Though they lynched us, we didn't give in. Though they kill us on video in broad daylight and hide behind shiny badges to absolve themselves of all responsibility, we refuse to back down. I didn't have to take the adverse childhood experiences test or study trauma's effects on the developing child's brain as I did at Harvard University for a year to know that truth. I can feel it in my bones. I can't not feel it. I can hear it subtly coursing through my veins. It colors everything I think and feel. That's the part of the American story many don't want to hear, that we overcomers have wounds that won't heal, that can only be managed, that we must reconcile ourselves to. That's not a cry for help. It's a scream for recognition, not for those of us who have trod the stony road, but for those still making their way up the rough side of the mountain." So that is just a sampling of this beautifully written book. So for those of you who have not yet read it, that is what you have in store. But I just thought that that passage really spoke to what this book is about and gives us a really good flavor for that. Isaac, you've written so honestly about your childhood and the many difficulties that you faced growing up in your family. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that sort of informs your life and work now?
Yeah, sure. And one of the open wounds, what it is that you actually literally hear, like in my voice, like is my stutter, for instance, mm-hmm. Manifestations like of that early childhood trauma. Seeing like my dad sort of like actually beat my mom, and also sort of like actually dealing with poverty, and also sort of when I actually was like 9 years old, oldest brother he actually went to prison for like murder. Yes, and so like all of those things combined, and also sort of This was happening in the deep south, where Jim Crow, like our sort of, that should still linger. And that was, yes, like in that was so many different kinds of ways. Yes. Well, yes, like also, and one of the toughest things about it, like, is that, like, on like the one hand, that they actually try to like actually make you hate your black skin, and also some like actually try to like actually make you doubt your self-worth, like as a black person. And also sort of on top of that, yes, and then that even sort of actually when you make it out anyway, and then they try to like actually use your story in order to like actually shame others who are still struggling.
Well, you wrote about that, and you said that there was a time when you told your story differently, and it was sort of the pull yourself up by the bootstraps version. But you said that you found that that was actually harmful to other people who were still struggling, because the hearers would say, well, you made it, what's wrong with everybody else? And exactly. You wrote that changed the way that you now tell your story.
Yes. I mean, it's like, absolutely. And then that, that is why, like, I tried to tell people time and time again that I am not a self-made man. That I am not here, like, only because I was tougher than everybody else and smarter than everybody else and did the right thing all the time, simply because that's not true. Yes, and because, like, I saw that actually needed food stamps, like, in order to, like, actually survive. And also that, we actually needed, these free lunches, like, and, like, those, like long boxes of sort of, cheese, like, actually from the government, and the white beans, yes, golly, like, and, like, the powdered milk, and just, like, and these sort of, like, Pell Grants, and I ordered so many other things. Like, I sort of like actually needed all of those things, like, in order to, like, actually get to where I am now. Mm-hmm. Just, like, and also that I got, like, yes, like, I got sort of, like, breaks, at least, like, sometimes, like, actually from a kind teacher, yes, like, and also from the strangers, and that was so many different kinds of people, really, like, who are, really, like, who actually made me possible. Yes, and so, like, for me, like, I tried to, like, actually emphasize, like, that piece of the story. Yes, and because, like, I don't want anybody to, like, actually be let off the hook. Yes, like, I sort of also want, like, folks to know that, their little piece, like, actually can also sort of actually make a difference, like, actually for a struggling child as well.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the racial reckoning that we have seen this year in America. And you mentioned several cases in the book, instances of police brutality, instances of criminal justice gone awry. And certainly it seems that the reckoning that we've seen in America started in earnest with the murder of George Floyd. And then you probably know that here in Philadelphia, we had a police shooting recently in West Philadelphia, Walter Wallace, and plenty of protests following that as well. I wonder what you made of all that and what you were thinking as you watched these protests unfold all through the summer and kind of how you were thinking about that.
Yeah. Yes. And that that too was something that like I was struggling with. Yes, like, and because at least like on like the one hand, like I was trying to be somewhat optimistic. Simply because we had never seen that level of protest that widespread for right. like that long. Yes. Which is a good thing. Yes. And so like I saw that and I was trying to like actually hold on to that. Yes, me. But also like I absolutely know how hard it is, like, in order to, like, actually make real long lasting change. And then so like my sort of like fear about it was that we would, like, actually have really all of this energy. Yes, and then that, like, it actually would, like, actually just lead to a couple of changes. Yes, and then that, like, it would die out. Yes, and then that, like, all of the rooted in problems would still be there at the end.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's like that is still my fear, at least about this reckoning.
So, Isaac, one of the conversations that I was hearing, you know, during the summertime was that, you know, the protesting is important and critical, and it needs to keep happening. And you know, we need to draw attention to things that have been going on for 400 years. And now we kind of have that attention. Is there a point where it's time to maybe call a halt to the protesting and begin to, you know, try some other avenues to really strategize, to come off the street and really begin to strategize? Okay, we've got attention. What do we do now to create that meaningful change, the long-lasting change that you were just describing?
Yes. I mean, yes, like, and, like, for me, like, I think that we actually need to, like, actually keep on doing both. Mm. I guess, like, and sort of, like, one of the good trends that I've seen recently is that we are, like, now starting to, like, actually get in sort of, like, these kinds of prosecutors, really, like, who actually seem to understand that justice, like, isn't only about punishment. I mean, yeah, so, like, if we start there, and I think that that is happening more and more, like, fortunately.
And when you say that justice is not just about punishment, what do you mean?
Yes, like, and because at least, like, actually for a very, very long time in this country, that like, if you were so-called real kind of like tough on crime, mm-hmm. and then you, like, actually sort of actually went for, like, long prison sentences, and you actually tried to, yes, like, and sort of, like, even tried to, like, actually prosecute kids as adults, etc. I mean, yes, and then that actually was the kind of bipartisan standard, like, in this country for a very long time, and it actually caused a lot of problems all over this country. I mean, yes, and it's, like, for me, that at least I'm actually seeing that is changing somewhat. Yes, and it's, like, for me, like, kind of, like, if we can keep pushing on that by itself. Mm-hmm. Yes, and then, like, I think that actually would do, oh my God, yes, I mean, like, it actually would be so, so damn great, like, over the long haul.
Yeah. You write that white evangelical Christianity is not incompatible with white supremacy.
Right.
You are a Christian yourself. For many years, you worshiped at a white evangelical church. I have noticed, Isaac, that since 2016, there have been a number of stories popping up in the media about Black Christians who worshiped at white evangelical churches who have left and found themselves feeling sort of spiritually homeless and trying to figure out what the next step is, owing to the election of Donald Trump and the support that they saw in those churches. Can you talk about your experience? Why you left and sort of your read on white evangelical support for Donald Trump?
Yeah, that has been one of the most painful parts of this period, frankly. Yes, because it actually felt like this deep betrayal, honestly. Yes, like, and because that, these were people that I sort of actually went to church with, like, as you said, and, you know, prayed with, and my aunt sort of, like, actually loved on their kids and had them love on mine, etc., like, all of those things, like, and also that, like, I was, like, actually able to witness to them, like, at least, like, in terms of at least, like, about race and racism, etc., like, over all of those years we did all of those things together, and it seems though that, like, it had been, like, actually making a difference, and yet as soon as sort of he actually came down back on the golden escalator yesterday, mm-hmm. suddenly they actually rushed to him anyway. He was saying all of these ugly and racist things about Black people, yes, about Mexicans, about time and time again, and yet my Christian friends were embracing him, and it actually cut deeply. That is one of the sort of toughest things, at least for me, as a Christian, actually coming out of this era is because if my faith actually can be used in service of a man like Donald Trump, mm-hmm. yes, and then that, what good is it? And that is a question that I am still struggling with.
Yeah. So, right. So it sounds like you're still sort of wrestling through.
Yeah.
Where am I in all of this? And where does my faith land right. in the midst of all of this?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
I want to talk about Confederate monuments, because you write about those as well in the book. And you know, Brian Stevenson has said, living in Alabama, that he lives in a land that is littered with monuments to, you know, sworn enemies of the United States at one point. Certainly there has been a reckoning over that this year as well, over these Confederate monuments. Some have come down in the wake of George Floyd's murder, but then there are plenty of people who are determined to keep those monuments there, to continue to fly the Confederate flag. And so I'm wondering, for you, as a Black man in the South, certainly you're no stranger to these markers. How are you thinking about those monuments these days?
At least for me, what I try to equate it with is that if you can actually think about actually being a Jewish person in Germany, after the war, after Hitler, et cetera, and then that, and yet though sort of at your sort of Capitol building, you actually saw these monuments to Hitler at the sort of courthouse door. Yes, and you saw these monuments to Hitler. And also that you actually had to drive on roads, and sort of named after his lieutenants, et cetera. Well, that is how it has felt here, as a Black person, in a place like this. Yes, and also sort of on top of that, what we have had, white friends, et cetera, is this kind of admonishment, at least for us to actually try to sympathize with all of the folks who are sort of actually waving those flags, et cetera. For instance, in the summer of 2015, I was there, when the flag was finally taken down, off of our sort of state house grounds, after the massacre by Dylann Roof.
At the church.
Yes.
In South Carolina. Yes, at the Bible study.
Exactly. Yes, and then that, I was somewhat happy about it coming down, obviously. And yet though, that I sort of actually could not stop thinking about how that flag should have never been there in the first place. Mm. And so what was happening is that we were trying to get back to zero almost. Mm. Yes, at least with all of those emotional scars are still there, from all of these monuments and statues, and also especially the fact that we sort of are sort of actually walking on ground where there were slaves right on these grounds, in addition to all of those monuments and statues, for the enslavers. It is taxing every single day living here because of that.
And the president has defended those monuments and said, this is our heritage, and exactly. Wants to keep them there.
Yes.
I have, Isaac, a number of questions from our audience. So let's dive into a few of those and see what we've got here. Darren wants to know, do you feel that there should be reparations from the federal government as a means of compensating descendants of former slaves for previous crimes against humanity in the form of slavery?
Yes, and that, at least for me, that I actually have been grappling with this question for a long time. I've always had this kind of feeling. Whereas that it actually should not happen, should not be necessary, et cetera, simply because we always have been taught here, just try to ignore all of the bad stuff and actually just move on, et cetera. And yet though now that my kind of view on that has really changed. One of the things holding this country back, is our refusal in order to actually really be honest about ourselves. And I think that reparations, is a really important step, at least to actually trying to get to truth. I think that kind of truth now is so vital, which is why that I am much more in favor of it now than I was even 5 years ago.
Okay. Teresa says, your essay on Black men and violence captured a deep personal vulnerability. How can Black people overcome the unsubstantiated fear that we have toward each other?
You actually definitely actually tapped into one of the toughest chapters that in that book. In order to have that white people stereotype us or be afraid of us, etc. Which is bad by itself, but it is another thing in order for us to actually be afraid of ourselves. And that that is something that I know that I have absolutely actually had to overcome fighting against, frankly. Tried to find ways in order to actually uplift Black people, in particular, and also to remind us of our strength, and also of our worth and our beauty, and also our doggedness, in order to just keep on pushing forward no matter what. So many lies about ourselves that it is almost impossible in order for us to some of that in. That too is why I wrote my first book, in particular, I am trying to get us in order to feel less shame. And also just to explain Yes, in terms of kind of like how these sort of like systems and structures actually got us to this place. I mean, yes, and so like again for me, like it is absolutely vital that we sort of like absolutely like actually understand our worth and our value.
You know, I thought it was so interesting in the book where you said that violence has a way of clarifying things. And you talked about Liam Neeson and sort of that infamous admission that he, fantasized about murdering a random black man because a friend of his had been assaulted by a black man. And when you had a tragedy in your own family that, you know, your first thought was, the first person that you pictured was an African American, and you, I was so struck, Isaac, by your honesty and vulnerability in writing that and saying, hey, this is a really thorny thing that I'm having to wrestle through as a black man.
Actually going all the way back to sort of, yes, I guess that my son like actually was like born 19 years ago. And then that Lee sort of actually as my wife was pregnant, like my sort of like first fear, frankly, was that it actually would be a boy. And I sort of actually feared that simply because I knew that I was struggling in order to like actually separate at least like this idea of violence from young black men. Yes, and so like that was how sort of it was like that deep, at least like in me. And then, it has like actually taken, a lot of counseling and also like a lot of prayer, like in order for me to stop seeing, in terms of sort of violence and sort of like black men paired together. Yes, like, and also sort of like I was trying to be honest that way, but even though that it hurt, like, hey, by the way, to be frank with you. Yes, like, is because, like, I sort of like, actually want, yes, like, I sort of like, actually want to, like, actually make space for, like, other people to actually be able to, like, actually be honest about it as well. Yes, and then sort of, like, out of that honesty. Yes, and then that I think that, like, we can like, actually pull each other, kind of, like, out of that dark place.
Yeah. So appreciate your honesty in writing about that and giving people space for that very thing, for that, what is sometimes a lifelong process.
Yeah,
another question from Jake, and this one says, you wrote about Obama reaching out to angry white people in this country back in 2015. The same people would eventually become Trump's base. What were you seeing back then that allowed you to project what this country would look like today?
Yes. And so like essentially, like I saw the ground for somebody like Trump, like all the way back in like 2008. I mean, yes, like simply because like I sort of actually was like in this place and sort of I sort of like actually had like this largely white and conservative readership. Yes, and then so it was like almost overnight in sort of like November of that year that Obama won that their kind of attitude towards me changed. Yes, yes, me like that. Like it actually got extremely angry and extremely racist, like almost overnight. It's like, yes, and then that it almost like stunned me. Yes, like, and because, these folks like, actually had been like so nice for many, many years before that. I mean, yes, and then that, once they changed like that, like in like November of like 2008, like it like never stopped. Yes, and then so like for me, like, yes, and then that, that sort of actually made it possible in order for somebody like Donald Trump to come in order to like actually use that anger, et cetera.
Yeah, you saw this coming from a long way off, it sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
There is a message here for you, Isaac. It says, dear Isaac, don't give up. Keep up the protests and speaking the truth. You have many supporters and like-minded thinkers here in South Carolina. This is your home and we are your people. Thank you for your writing, Professor Maggie Morehouse.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So that is
thank you very much.
A word of encouragement for you from Professor Morehouse. Let's see, a couple more minutes here. This question says, why did we protest more than riot?
Yeah, yes. At least like actually when I was coming up with the title of the book, at least for me, like it actually was about how that even though that like all of this stuff actually had been going on in our area for years, and yet like we talk about actually did not have any riots or even protests, like even after sort of that cases like where sort of that cops like actually shoots people and actually lie about it. Yes, and then that we saw the actually just sort of let it go again and again and again and again. And then, for me, at least like actually when I saw that actually use the term riot, like I am not talking about looting. Like I am not talking about burning up a CVS, et cetera. Like what I am actually talking about, like is this really that clear and loud effort just to like actually make sure that folks in power like absolutely will always hear us and sort of like actually like absolutely cannot ignore us and also sort of like actually will be made to be like so uncomfortable that they like absolutely will absolutely have to act. So like for me, like that is what I want to see us keep on doing.
It's that communal scream that you talk about in the book. Yeah. Stephen asks, what suggestions would you offer for Christian communities who are earnestly seeking to address the work of racial justice and cultivating anti-racism work?
Yeah. Well, at least like the first thing that frankly, this country sort of like actually has to like actually start being honest with itself, kind of like on like the issue of race. Our church like actually has to start there as well. For me, it's like actually when I look at Christianity, like in this country, and that like I am convinced that like if sort of that on it, white Christians sort of like actually decided tomorrow that at least in terms of that they are sort of like absolutely like actually would be no more structural racism, et cetera, like those kind of things, then it absolutely would change. Simply because they actually have the numbers and also like the power, like in order to like actually really be able to change something like that. And yet though, for our entire history, that has never happened. Like that has never happened. And yes, and then that that is why like I say like in the book that like our faith, like as our like practice in this country, like actually like has like absolutely never been like incompatible with white supremacy. And so like therefore, like I think that we sort of actually have to start there. Yes, like and like actually own up to that. And then like also say why that is. And then sort of actually just go from there.
Yeah. Some hard conversations need to be had, it sounds like.
Yeah, for sure.
Isaac, I want to ask you something that I have been asking people that I've been had the privilege of interviewing lately, and that is that, you know, we're in the middle of this pandemic. We have watched this racial reckoning unfold. There is massive amounts of stress around the election, no matter what side of the political aisle you fall on. Immensely difficult year. And I wonder, in the midst of all of that, what gives you hope? What keeps you going in the midst of everything that is 2020?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, like, well, at least for me, like, I know that, like, there sort of actually were sort of like folks like who actually came before me, really like who actually dealt with like even like tougher issues and got through and sort of actually forced progress on this country. Yes, and so like for me, like that example alone sort of always gives me hope, and it also sort of like fuels me. Kind of like it is saying that like it is my turn, like in order to actually I need to like actually keep pushing that rock forward for sure. Yes, like and so like lastly, like what I try to do too, at least like in order to like actually not actually feel so helpless and down, etc., is that like I sort of actually try to like actually like remember that like we should also feel joy as well. So like for me, like I sort of always try to tell people that like we should like actually fight like this actually when we must, but that like we must like actually dance at least like actually when we can. Yes, like and because yes, I think that like if we lose sight of that kind of balance, yes, and then that a sort of like sense of helplessness like actually can set in, and then that that's all actually will be bad for us and also for the country overall.
Yeah, well said, great advice. Isaac Bailey, thank you so much for putting this wonderful book into the world. Why Didn't We Riot? A Black Man in Trump Land. I would encourage you, if you haven't read it already, to please pick up a copy and appreciate the wisdom that is contained in this book. Isaac, thank you so very much for writing the book and for spending some time sharing it with us tonight.
I said, thank you very much for having me, Trace.
And thanks to all of you who have joined us tonight and spent some time exploring these very, very important issues. I want to thank Andy, Jason, Laura, the whole author events team at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Please be well, stay safe, and we'll see you next time. Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit, and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.